they were required to personally write it out and to keep a copy of it for themselves. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 18. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priests. Now, sadly, it appears that the kings didn't do that. And in fact, tragically, for many years, the book of Deuteronomy appears to have gotten lost. But when it was rediscovered by Hilkiah in the temple, you remember what happens? He reads it before King Josiah. Josiah listens to the words of this book. He tears his clothes. And in response, he makes a covenant with the Lord. And it kickstarts the greatest civil and religious reform that Judah ever experiences. So Deuteronomy is an important book. It's a powerful book. It's a world-changing book. And truth be told, then, I did wonder whether by choosing Deuteronomy as the second book to preach through, I was getting into things which are too deep and too wonderful for me at this early stage of my ministry. And I'm sure that I won't be able to do this book the justice it deserves. And if any of the sermons in this series do strike you as dry or boring, then please place the blame on me and not on the book of Deuteronomy. But nevertheless, here we are. And we can hope and pray then that the Lord would bless us as we read this book and open our eyes and indeed feed our souls and do what he did for Josiah and do what he did even for Paul and many others who have gone before us reading this book. So, where do we start? Let's get ourselves a bit of context then. Where can we get that context from? Well, perhaps the first thing to do is just to dive straight into the passage and allow the passage to provide its own context, because that's precisely what it does. It positions itself geographically and historically. Look at verses 1 to 5. Because you'll see then that in these verses we are given a location. Verse 1 tells us that Moses is currently standing in the wilderness in the Arabah, that's what it says, next to the River Jordan, or literally on the east of the River Jordan. The Arabah, what we're talking about here, is the great gorge which runs down between, well, it really extends all the way down to the Persian Gulf, but the bit which is being talked about here is between the Sea of Galilee in the north and the Jordan then flowing down to the Dead Sea in the south. And we have then between those two points this great rift valley. It's a plain which at times is about 20 miles long, at other times it's about 5 miles long, probably an average of about 10 miles. And that plain then is called the Arabah. And Moses, he's standing right now on the east side of that plain, on the east side of the River Jordan. They haven't yet crossed it. They haven't yet entered Canaan. But he's standing there before the gathered congregation of Israel, it says. That's the location we're given. Notice we're also given a time stamp. This book is dated. So verse 3 tells us that it's in the 40th year. We'll come back to that in a second. In the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month. You see, in exactly a month and a half from now, Moses will be dead, and the people will have crossed over into the land of Canaan, and what will they be doing? They will be eating, celebrating their first Passover in the land of promise. So the point is then that both geographically and historically, the people of Israel are on the cusp of something special. This is a momentous occasion in the life of Israel. And it's this occasion then that really frames the whole of the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy is a series of farewell speeches given by Moses to that gathered congregation. Remember, Moses is not permitted to cross over the Jordan and go into that promised land, but that's what the people will be doing shortly from now. And so Moses then, he's taking this last moment of his life to make this series of farewell speeches to the gathered congregation of Israel. And the first of these speeches, then, it begins in verse 6 of chapter 1, and it will take us ultimately to verse 40 of chapter 4. And this, then, is where we begin this morning, then, standing with Israel on the edge of Canaan. And with the remaining time that we have this morning, I want to make 2 points. And I suppose my first point is really the bulk of what I'm going to say, then my final point, my second point is more a few concluding thoughts. But this is where I'm going with it. Before I get to those 2 points, the main idea behind all I'm saying is this, that if the people of Israel are going to now cross over into the land of Jordan, there's something that they first need to do. They need to consider their journey. The book of Deuteronomy and Moses' first speech in Deuteronomy gets us to look back at the journey which has led the people up to this momentous occasion. And by looking back, by considering their journey, the people find themselves provoked to respond in 2 ways. And these are my 2 points this morning. Firstly, by considering their journey, they should be encouraged. By considering their journey, they should be encouraged. I said just now that Deuteronomy begins by giving us a time and a location. But notice how their current location is given in relation to the previous locations. So verse 2 tells us that where the people currently are now is 11 days' journey from Horeb. Now, where is Horeb? Well, Horeb is the word that Deuteronomy uses for Sinai. That's the mountain where Israel first met with their God and first received the law. By the way, the name Deuteronomy means second law. It's not the title that the Jews would have given to this book, but it's the title that we use today. And deutero then means second, and nomos in Greek means law, so deuteronomy, second law, because the point is, while the people received that first law and covenant at Horeb, at Sinai, it's here then that Moses, on the verge of the Jordan, repeats that law for a second time. And the point is then that Israel then, it's being positioned in relation to Horeb. Because this is all about Israel's journey from Horeb. The other locations on that list, on that verse, verse 1, you see them there starting from Suf all the way to Disahab. They're very difficult locations to identify. Anything I said about them would be speculation. But some of them at least, Paran, Laban, Hazeroth, they do hark back to places where the Israelites had previously encamped on their journey through the wilderness, staging posts, again, on their journey. So you see, the overall impression that we have here is of a people in motion. They haven't yet crossed the Jordan into the land of promise, but they have got this far. Behind them is this great journey from Horeb through the wilderness and these various staging posts and now to the Arabah. And it's not just a geographical journey that we're seeing here. It's a historical journey as well. Sometimes people say, the books of the Bible are inspired, but the order of the books are not inspired. And that's basically true. The Jews had a variety of ways of ordering the Old Testament, all of which are different from the way that we Christians order these books. But even still, the order of the books is important, often. And that's particularly true when you come to the first books of the Bible. And to show you what I mean by this, look at how the book of Deuteronomy begins. Look at the very first words of this book. Verse 1. These are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel beyond the Jordan in the wilderness. And now that you've seen that, just turn back a page to the book of Numbers and read the very last words of the book of Numbers. Numbers 36, verse 13. These are the commandments and the rules that the Lord commanded through Moses to the people of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. So what you instantly see then is that these two books are tied together. their ends are stitched together like that. And if you go home tonight and you look through all of the books of the Pentateuch, Genesis to Deuteronomy, and even on to Joshua, what you see is actually that all of these books deliberately flow from one to the other. Someone, whether it's Moses or not, has deliberately stitched the ends together so that you progress through these books like pearls on a necklace. And again, then, we come back to my point. The overall effect of this is that you get this sense of journey, this sense of motion, this sense of progression. These books are in chronological order. So Deuteronomy, it doesn't just sort of stand by itself as this separate book which can float around wherever it likes. No, it's the final book in the books of Moses. And the very first words of this book tie us back to that journey which is led until now. Actually, in our versions here, the first verse begins, "These are the words that Moses spoke." In some of the ancient manuscripts, the first word of Deuteronomy is actually the word "and." "And these are the words that Moses spoke." It gives, again, the impression that we're moving on from what has gone before. It's reminding us of the journey beforehand. So this is my first point this morning. As the people are standing here on the verge of Jordan, and as they're about to take that land by force, they are now being encouraged to reflect back on that long, epic journey. And what I'm saying now is that that should have been a source of encouragement for them. And encourage is the right word. It should have put courage into their hearts. Because where did this long journey begin? We've looked at Horeb already, but as I said, Deuteronomy, it belongs to this chain of books which begins with Genesis. And so it shouldn't surprise us then that in verse 8, Moses refers our minds back further than just Horeb. In verse 8, he reminds us of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the promise which was given to them. And what was the promise? It was a promise which was given to them and to their offspring of a land. And what was that land? Well, it's the land beyond the river. It's the land that the people of God are now gazing out towards. The only reason that they were standing on the edge of the Jordan in the first place was because of that ancient promise. And if ever these Israelites then were unsure whether God could fulfill that promise, if ever they needed encouragement that God would be with them as they stepped out over the Jordan, all they had to do was to look back at that journey. Remember, many of the people in that crowd had been there in Egypt as little boys and little girls or teenagers. Their parents would have told them way back at that time about this man called Moses who was going to deliver them out of slavery and bring them to that land. And many of those people in this crowd then would have had, as a child, memories impressed upon their minds of those great events which happened in Egypt. Many of the little boys in that crowd, or many of the men in that crowd, would have been little boys at the time when the first night of the Passover took place, sheltering under the blood of the lamb, worried about the angel of destruction, and their parents reassuring them, "No, the angel's going to pass over. We've put the blood upon the doorposts." Many of the people in this crowd would have had the visions of those great of that great expanse of water being stretched out before them in the Red Sea and then marching through to the other side. They would have had these images impressed upon their minds. They would have remembered, of course, Horeb itself and God appearing on that mountain in a column of smoke and the trumpet blasts. They would have had all of this impressed upon their minds. And they would have had then every reason to believe that right now God was capable of fulfilling those promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and taking them over to the land of promise. And you know, even for those who perhaps had forgotten about Egypt or weren't even alive when the people were in Egypt, these people who were maybe born in the wilderness, even they would have had real reasons to believe that God was capable of taking them across the Jordan. Because notice the context here. Moses is making this speech. Look at what it says in verse 4. after he had defeated Sihon, the king of the Amorites, and Og, the king of Bashan. Remember Sihon and Og? I think sometimes we don't give a significant enough place in our minds to certain Bible characters. Well, I want to give Sihon and Og that significant place in your mind. Imagine Sihon and Og as a giant pair of double doors which once barred Israel's entrance to the Promised Land. And I say a giant pair of double doors. Deuteronomy goes on to tell us that Og himself was literally a giant. The Amorites had his bed, and it was huge. And Sihon himself, we can't say for sure, but there are reasons to believe he may have been a giant as well. But what happens then is that Israel, in the strength of God, first batters open that first door, defeats Sihon, and then batters open that second door, defeats Og. And if that event hasn't stuck in your minds as something memorable, it really was memorable to the people of Israel. Deuteronomy refers to Sihon and Og several times, not just Deuteronomy. Joshua reminds the people of Sihon and Og. In the book of Judges, Jephthah, the judge, tells the story again of Sihon and Og. You know, Nehemiah refers to Sihon and Og. And we read those, that Psalm 135 and 136 also remind the people of Sihon and Og. And for these people then, standing there in the Arabah, they're still panting, really, from that victory. They're still wiping the sweat from their brows and the blood from their swords. And this was the first taste of true victory for some of them. And to put it mildly then, that would have been an enormous confidence boost as they looked across the Jordan. It was exciting. If God had already used his people to topple those scary giants who had tried to stand in their way, well, so long as their faith was in that God, there was nothing that could stop them now. Yes, the Lord would fulfill his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Lord had rolled back his sleeve and shown the world his muscles. And so what were the giants of Canaan compared to that God? And as we go on through Deuteronomy, we'll see that Moses himself encourages the people in that way. He says, your eyes have seen all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. This is what he says to Joshua in chapter 3. So will the Lord do to all the kingdoms into which you are crossing. You shall not fear them, for it is the Lord your God who fights for you. And so to take it back to my heading then, this is why it was so important for the people right now to consider their journey up until the present point. It was a source of encouragement and empowerment as they faced those unknown lands ahead. Now, I don't know where you are this morning in your Christian life. I don't know how far off you are from entering our promised land of rest, from entering that heavenly country. All of us at one point will have to cross the Jordan. But maybe you do feel like you are now on the brink of the Jordan, so to speak. Well, wherever you are and whoever you are, if you are a believer in Jesus Christ, I want you to see that you too have all the blessings that Israel did. You too can look back and consider your journey. But when you do that, I want you to see that actually you can be more excited, more hopeful, more at peace than Israel could ever be. You too step out in the presence of great promises and in the presence of a great liberation. And you too step out knowing that your God is powerful over your enemies. But listen, your promises and your liberation and your knowledge of God's power can be even bigger than what Israel had. A lot has happened since the days of Deuteronomy. The journey has progressed even further. And because of that, then, you now can be confident that our God is not just the God who destroys Egyptians or Amorites or even huge giants like Og and Bashan. You can be confident that this is the God who has now defeated Satan himself and all his armies lying there right now under the feet of Jesus Christ, your Saviour. He has done away with that threat on the day when he died on that cross and later rose from the grave. He had victory over your greatest enemy. And if your faith is in him, then he will have victory over the grave as well. And what you can be confident of now is not just the promise of a land in the Middle East and a few hundred thousand square kilometres, although that was a vast promise that the people were receiving. No, your promise is of an eternal rest, of a new creation, of a happy, restored paradise. And that means then that as you stand here right now with your faith in God, you can look across that plain, you can look across that river with a sense of genuine excitement. I am going to enter this better Canaan, and whatever doubts might be whispering in my ears, I have every confidence that my God is powerful beyond belief and he will get me there. So look back, Christian. Look back at the journey. Look back at how he has delivered you even up until this point of your life. How on all those different occasions in your life when you were stubborn and hard-necked and resisted God, nevertheless he was faithful to you and his steadfast love endured forever and his Holy Spirit preserved you and kept you going and kept you serving him. And this is the God then who will see you over that final stretch. And in view of that then, be encouraged, take courage, allow the courage of God to fill your heart. So looking back then, looking back at our journey, considering our journey, it should have been a source of courage for these Israelites. But then secondly, and really this is very brief now, looking back at their journey, considering their journey, should have warned them. It should have warned them. Because as we finish this morning, let me also remind you that as Israel stood there on the cusp of Canaan, there was another reason why it was important to look back. Because looking back was a sobering thing. It reminded the people that they really did need to put their faith in this God of theirs. Look again at verse 2. Interesting, isn't it? Verse 2 tells us it's 11 days' journey from Horeb, by the way of Mount Seir, to Kadesh Barnea. Then verse 3 comes along in the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month. So you read verse 2 and you think, 11 days then, just a bit of a doddle, just less than 2 weeks maybe since they were in Horeb and standing before the Lord at Sinai. No, that's not what we're told. In the 40th year. The 40th year since what? The 40th year, actually, since the people were at Horeb. At Sinai. So what could have been an 11 days journey between Horeb and the Promised Land had become 40 years for the people of God. And except for Joshua and except for Caleb and except for Moses, everyone who was over the age of 20 when the Exodus took place, they were now dead in the wilderness. And why was that? Well, simply because the parents of these Israelites who are now standing there on the banks of Canaan, they had stubbornly refused to enter the land that their God was giving them. And this is the story then that Moses is going to unfold for us over the next couple of chapters. Now in verse 6, I've told you already, Moses' speech, his first speech begins. And it begins by him recounting this history of Israel since they left Horeb. And what does he say? Verse 6, the Lord our God said to us in Horeb, you have stayed long enough at this mountain, turn and take your journey and go to the hill country of the Amorites and to all their neighbours in the Arabah, in the hill country and in the lowland and in the Negeb and by the seacoast, the land of the Canaanites and Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, you know, the Israelites Moses is speaking to then, are not, by and large, the same Israelites who left Egypt. This is the second generation. These are the children of all those stubborn rebels whose bodies fell in the wilderness. And so what is Moses now saying to them? Well, he's warning them and he's reminding them that actually these are not the first generation to arrive at this momentous occasion, to have this glorious opportunity to enter the land of promise. No, their parents were faced with the same moment. At Horeb, God had sent them out to conquer the land. And what big promises he'd given them. Huge promises to claim. Look at what he says there. From the seacoast of Negev, he says, as far as the river Euphrates. Now, I'm sure at this point Ray would love me to have a projection of a map up on the screen. But if you go home and have a look, you'll realise that the land which Moses is describing here is far bigger than the land which the Israelites go on to actually conquer. The Euphrates, it's not just the north of Israel, it's not just the north of Lebanon above Israel, it's the north of Iraq. It's a huge river. And so you see what these people have been promised. They've been promised an enormous promise, an enormous land. And he'd said to them right there and then at Horeb, look, this is the promise. It's all yours. Step out into it. Step out into that scary world with your faith in me. I will protect you. I will bless you. I will give you more than you can ask or imagine. And what happened? Well, Moses is going to tell us what happened over the next couple of chapters. The simple answer is that the people did not seize their promise. Parents of these Israelites didn't go out with their faith in the Lord. They turn their noses up at the promised land, and in the Lord's punishment, they get what they ask for. Their bodies fall in the wilderness. And Moses is saying, don't be like your parents. Don't do what they did. No, seize the promise. Put your faith in the Lord and enter Canaan. And let me just finish then by saying, this is a warning that we all need to receive, even today, even here, even in this church. I read Hebrews chapter 3 for us this morning because it applies that warning to us very forcefully. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who were those who heard and yet rebelled? Was it not all those who left Egypt by Moses? And with whom was he provoked for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were unable to enter because of unbelief. And so Hebrews warns us, take care, brothers, lest there be any evil in you, an unbelieving heart leading you to fall away from the living God. And so I ask you then this morning, are you taking care? Is your faith in this God? Are you walking obediently by his side? Or are you at risk of falling away and denying him? And I'm saying, please reflect humbly upon those warnings. And let's then, in response to that, do what Hebrews tells us to do. In the words of Hebrews 3, it tells us that we should be exhorting each other every day. So long as it's called today, we should be exhorting each other against the deceitfulness of sin that hardens our hearts. We should be reminding ourselves, keep on going, brother. Keep on persevering, sister. Is your faith still in him? And as we do that, and as we fix our eyes on that promised land and say, yes, I am going to receive that by the grace of God. My faith is in you, Lord Jesus. You have had victory over all these enemies of mine. Now let me faithfully serve you in this life. As we do that, then we can be confident that we are entering into this happy rest that the Lord desires for us to enter into. Let us do that. Let us heed these warnings, and let's exhort one another to keep on following our God. Amen.